presenting some special material around that, as well as your participation in coming down helping answer the phones. Yes, we will be doing a fundraiser. It's one of the major fundraisers for WBAI, so we'll tell you a little bit more about that later on in the afternoon and tomorrow and the next day as well. It's 1 p.m. in New York City. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind from Hair. Remember that?
And social injustice. Do you only care about the bleeding crowd? How about a needing friend? I need a friend.
This is Armand DeMille with you with Dr. Bernard Stirrer. We're looking at a continuation yesterday about people and people and their cruelty and people and how they behave in certain ways. A recent research piece was released by Stanley Milgram. This is something done in the 60s. I'm going to ask Bernie to, he's done quite a bit of work on this. And it was released, Bernie, let's talk about this. It was released, this research project was kind of thrown out to the public on December 19th.
Yes, it was a replication of Milgram's work that was done back in the 60s.
And who did the replication?
It was psychologist Arthur Miller.
And Arthur Miller, the psychologist, did this replication, and then he did this replication of this early study, which was basically meant to prove people will be cruel if you give them the permission to do it.
Yes, or if an authority orders them to do it.
Or an authority orders them to do it.
And it addresses the issue, are we basically cruel, just poised for an opportunity to unleash this? And Milgram's experiment actually was very simple. He did this at Yale University in 1961. He recruited volunteers through an advertisement to participate in a learning experiment. And they were brought into a laboratory at Yale, and there was the experimenter there. And the volunteers were divided into teachers and students. Okay, the teachers are the ones that were going to administer shock to the learners when they gave wrong answers. The learners, though, were actors. Okay, and they were in another.
Let me slow it down a little, okay? Because we got a lot of fast.
Okay.
So back then, he advertises. He said, "Let's get some people for an experiment. People volunteer for the experiment." And he says, "We're going to break into two categories: teachers and learners." The teachers are people who will be listening to people answer questions, and according to how they answer it, they will do what? What will they do?
They will administer shock. They're shown a
electroshock.
Electric shock. They're shown, but it's fake, okay? But they're shown a generator, and the generator increases the shock.
But they don't know it's fake. Before we get
no, they don't know that it's fake.
Okay,
they believe that it's real.
Okay. So they get it, and they're even to convince them that it's real, each one of the teachers are allowed to feel the shock themselves.
Yes, they're offered the opportunity to feel the lowest level, 15 volts, which is very minimal, and most of them accepted that. So they believe it's real because they feel a shock.
So here's what I think is real now. I'm one of the teachers, and I know Bernie is one of my students, and now I can't see you anymore because they separate you, right? I know you're hooked up to wires.
Right, but they see them attached, an electrode attached to their arm.
So I saw you attached, right? And
yes.
Then suddenly I can't see you anymore.
Exactly.
Right now, I am told by someone to administer this shock to you because you answered the question wrong.
Right. And these
how would these instructors do? Oh, so now they take the students out. The students are not really getting shocked.
No.
Right?
No.
But they have actors in place making believe they're getting shocked.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right.
And every time the actor or the student gives an incorrect answer, the teacher is told to increase the voltage. There are 30 switches on there with the 15-volt increases up to 400 volts. They can't see the students, but they could hear them. And being actors, they're instructed to increase their complaints. Some of them at some point, when the voltage gets up high, say, oh, I can't stand this anymore, you know, let me go. And still, they're instructed to increase the voltage.
The teachers are instructed to increase the voltage on the people whose voices they hear.
Right.
They're hearing voices, and the voices are really actors making believe they're getting shocked.
Exactly.
Now, why this is important, this is an important study, because just recently, this past month, the one who replicated this was using this as evidence about authority and people's vulnerability to authority. So let's look at what happened now. Now the people who are the teachers are being told, increase that voltage. And, you know, so let's say you increase the voltage a little bit. At first you think you're giving a buzz to somebody, 15 volts. Now you're told, give them 30 volts. Give them 60 volts. Oh, I can't do it. I can't do it. We'll do it. And you do it, and the person goes, ah, and they scream a little bit. Any level, which from my understanding went to the level of outright screaming at one point.
Yes, of very serious complaints.
And at that point, the person would be even told to punish them even more.
Yes. In fact, Milgram had four different prods. And two of the last ones were very authoritarian, like a person would object, say, really, I don't feel like going on. And the experimenter would say, you must go on. Okay. And many of them did. Now, I'm sure most of our listeners hearing this right now and putting themselves in that place, they're saying to themselves, that's incredible. I wouldn't do that. Okay. I wouldn't do that. And I think most of us feel that. And that's why this study got so much attention, because quite astonishingly, 65% of these ordinary people, under those circumstances, were willing to go up to the maximum of 400 volts.
Maximum of 400 volts, capable almost of killing somebody.
Well, I don't know about killing somebody, but they certainly were believing that they were inflicting serious pain.
65%
And in the that was Milgram's study, the replication that was just done, and there were some restrictions on the replication because most of the objections to Milgram were on ethical grounds of how could you put these teachers under such stress, because many of them, after the experiment, were very upset about this. So under the new experiment, Arthur Miller could only go up as high as 140 volts and couldn't use those two most extreme commands, you know, you must continue this. But still, they went up, 70% of his went up to 400 volts, to 140 volts. And he said it was justified because in Milgram's work, the ones that went to 140 volts were willing to go to 400.
Now, why would some people grab this and say, aha, now, here we have evidence that soldiers will torture people in Abu Ghraib, that Iraqi people will kill people because they... What were they trying to make a case for?
Well, that's the case they were making. And as a matter of fact, what called my attention to this and why I looked into the replication and then wrote a column on it last week was that 2 weeks ago, the New York Times had an editorial making that exact connection. They said, aha, you know, here's a replication of the work, and this shows and explains to us what happened at Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo.
There is a power of authority to command even the nicest people to commit crimes of unspeakable, well, not even unspeakable, just crimes, and that the pressure of the authority will make you do it. Now, that's only for certain people. Now, we can make an argument about the military, because people who go into the military are saying, I will accept the command and the judgment of anybody who commands me. I think what this study was also saying was that ordinary people would follow the same thing.
Yes, I mean, that's why it has gotten so much attention, and that's why for the last 40 years it's been considered one of the most landmark experiments in psychology, and it catapulted Milgram to the level of one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century.
He got struck by lightning. He died. Bernie Starr. So Bernie Starr takes on the community. He says, no, it doesn't prove that. Why do you say it?
Well, first, I was always disturbed by this study and didn't believe it, although the results were the results. Now, why didn't I believe this? Okay, here we're using this, and we just discussed it, as an analogy for many of the cruelties that go on in the world. But if we stand back and look at this experiment, we say, hey, he brought in ordinary people. They didn't know this experimenter. The experimenter is not a real authority. And it's happening on a college campus at Yale University. Okay? The teachers who are inflicting this, or believe they're inflicting this pain, are inflicting it on people that they don't know. So this is not analogous to situations where there's hatreds, historic and ethnic hatreds, where you have a despotic regime that is encouraging violence and whatnot. And I always thought, hey, if people are willing to commit pain, to inflict pain on people in this very neutral situation, that's really scary. And I said, I don't believe this, but I could not quite find the flaw in the experiment, but I think that I found it now, and that is that the replication doesn't prove anything to me. For me, the big question is, would they do it again, those teachers? Because, let's face it, they were caught off guard. They're dragged into a college campus for an experiment in learning. They don't know anybody. They're a little confused. They're being paid to do it. There's the experimental effect. Gee, would they really inflict pain at Yale University in a laboratory? And the whole thing happens within an hour. Well, that's not an analogy for Iraq or other situations or Germany, because those were people who inflicted cruelty every day. And here, this happened in an hour. My question is, if you brought them back in there, would they do it again? And I don't believe that they would. I think that when they would become conscious of what they were doing, when their conscience would kick in, that that some kind of basic goodness would prevail, would come out.
You don't believe. You believe that people are basically good.
Yes, I think so. I don't subscribe to that Freudian view that we're all basic animalistic instincts at our core.
And that our basic animalistic instinct are competitive, and we will kill each other if we have to, because we'll do it to survive and to win. You don't believe that?
No. Or the other view of Freud's, that we become socialized, that we become social beings as a kind of second best, because basic instincts don't work. You can't just go out and demand things and grab people if you want sex. I mean, rape doesn't work, that you have to socialize and that you have to do things in another manner. So he saw our whole socialization and our social beingness on this planet as a compensation, kind of, as a second best.
This is Armand DeMille with Dr. Bernie Starr. We're talking about the work and the recent popularity or popularization of Stanley Milgram's 1960s experiments, which have just come about, and they've become very, very popular. Now, why were they held back till December 19th, or they were just released?
Well, it was embargoed for journalists. They had their hands on it because it's reported in the January issue of the American Psychologist, and that was released, I guess, on December 19th. But when I Googled it, the entire world press jumped on that on December 19th.
So why do you think it was embargoed?
Because the American Psychological Association didn't want it released until the issue of the magazine came out.
Oh, and you mean for the typical. Sake of the magazine?
Yes. Yeah, no, that's typical. If you go to conferences and you go to the press room.
You're making a case for how good people are, and you're telling me that the American Psychological Association won't release this data because they want to sell magazines?
Well, that's where
those are our leaders. Yeah, those
but
are
that's
the
where it's reported. This happens in journalism all the time.
I know.
You know, when
I
you
know.
Go to a meeting, you go to the press room, and they'll give you the papers that are going to be presented, but they'll embargo it until the paper's presented. They don't want it out before the guy has an opportunity to present his wares.
Let's not give that medicine anywhere until we can get some kind of a.
Well, I'm not sure that that's exactly the case.
All right. So anyway, it's out there. But
it's out.
So, Bernie, you grabbed this. Now, the nature of cruelty is kind of an interesting thing because, you know, there are people who, if you look at some of the habits of chicks in a nest, I think it's two eagles. An eagle will have two babies, and one baby will automatically kill the inferior baby. You know, if it has two, it only has only one survives, and the weaker one gets killed by the older one. Pretty sibling stuff. I mean, that's not all eagles, but certainly the eagles that are not Connecticut eagles. They would never do that, and not New England eagles, but some of those mean eagles do it. But if you have this kind of nature of sibling rivalry. Don't you think there's a basic cruelty that starts early on when the resources are not very available? You know, like if you have limited resources, don't you think that engenders a kind of cruelty competition?
Well, sure, but hopefully evolution has ratcheted up us humans to a little higher level than the birds killing the inferior. Sibling, but of course, and there's a lot of research to back it up, that in hard times, under all kinds of pressures and deprivations, the worst in people come out. We're seeing that currently in the economic crisis. I saw a report the other day of a marked increase in bank robberies.
Bank robberies?
Mm-hmm.
By adults who are on Medicare. That's the latest thing.
Well, that
no, bank robberies, really. Really, people robbing banks. But you see the thing that I'm addressing is in some cultures, where I grew up, we were poor. And we were fighting to keep ahead of each other, if we could, or really keep our heads above water. But we had a kind of a code. You don't rob your brother. You don't rob your neighbor. You don't do things. You know, you don't, if you're competing, it's like you're all part of a team and you're competing against the world in general. And a lot of people who are under duress and under stress, who are impoverished, they kind of band together. That's one kind. Then there's another kind where people turn against each other. How would you separate those two personalities? What do you think makes one person cruel and criminal and makes another person, you know, cooperative?
Well,
what do you think the difference is?
That's a huge question, and there's many dimensions to that. There
okay.
are first,
so what do you think?
Well, there's biological differences. In some cases, people may be wired. This is a big controversy within physiology and psychology. Some people wired for violence, for cruelty, and there's some evidence that that is the case. Then, of course, a lot.
I have a raptor in my DNA. Yeah. You know, I have a dinosaur raptor in my
well,
DNA.
Well, you know, it could be that
yeah.
there are
okay.
genetic differences among people. Then, of course, there is the differences in political climates and societies and the standards of societies. I mean, if you want to draw a stark analysis, there are some indigenous societies where cannibalism is permitted. You know, it's part of the culture, so, but that's an extreme example. But there's a whole continuum. So there are certain things in some societies that are acceptable. Some are supported by religious beliefs, you know, ethnic differences, by philosophies. And then you have despotic governments that permit all kinds of things or set the stage for all kinds of cruel and violent behaviors to come out. So, I mean, there's a whole host of reasons, and there's much in the variances in socialization of how we're brought up and how we're trained in terms of competition, in terms of compassion, in terms of feelings for other people. So I think there's a whole range of explanations that you can't come up with.
Well, you do think, though, but I remember from your most recent book, there is one particular explanation that you have, which has to do with the connection.
Yes. Well, if we want to talk about a spiritual perspective on this, and even beyond the spiritual perspective, recent findings and theories within physics, within the science realm, the notion of interrelatedness, the notion of oneness within spirituality and spiritual traditions, there's a notion of a universal consciousness that we are all one. Within physics, there's the notion now that everything in the universe is interrelated. Well, if that's true, and if we can genuinely get into a state, and if that's our basic nature of oneness, the sense of oneness, of interconnectedness, well, then that has to modulate some of this violence that we're talking about. What contributes to a lot of hatred and violence and cruelty is the sense of separateness, that you and I are different and that we are little specks in this vast universe and we're fighting for our own little turf there, and that's going to generate violence at some point. Okay.
There's no question in your mind that we are all connected, right, Bernie?
Yes,
there's no question.
Belief.
Yes, you believe we are all connected. That people are connected, and human nature is to be connected. Therefore,
right, and that socialization and the way we're brought up and our individual psychologies right out of the gate when we're born take us away from that consciousness. And I think for many people,
some people, because if you have a loving family and you have a family that keeps the connection, you feel the continuity. I believe if you have a loving, nurturing family, you keep a continuity of your connection.
Well,
have a derisive family or if you have a painful family, very often you feel that separateness. Every kid sitting in their room alone crying.
Yes, that will certainly exacerbate it.
Love
helps. But love, frankly...
I didn't say love, actually. I said loving family.
Loving family.
Meaning that the family kind of gives a nurturance connection, and then the child has to take from that whether or not they want to be... the child can either feel it or not feel it. If the child feels disconnected for whatever reason, whether it be their chemistry, whether it be the family chemistry, or whether it be situational or the food they're eating or anything. But if that child feels separate, then that child does not feel the connection to all around them.
Yeah, absolutely. And to add to that, that person is likely to have, throughout his life, a very defensive posturing and a great emphasis on separation in terms of you and me. I mean, and that space between us and my need to protect me and my turf.
And so since there is a separateness between you and me, because I am separate, I'm in my room, and I'm alone, and I'm not connected to anybody, then there's nobody to take care of me but me. And there is nobody there for me. I'm not connected. So if I have to fight you or be jealous of you or be angry at you, and I see you as a separate being, not I see you as part of me, then I could easily objectify you. I could do things, compete with you, hurt you, because I'm not hurting myself. Because if you feel that you're connected to everyone around you, how can you hurt them?
Exactly. And I think calling it objectifying other people is a good way of looking at it, because when somebody else becomes an object, they don't have the value and the same meaning to us when we feel that connection. And even some of our philosophies, which purport to bring us closer to this oneness, really don't. I mean, isn't it quite astonishing that the God principle, the one God principle, doesn't bring people together? Here you have different religions all over the world, presumably worshiping the one God, the same God, and still you have violence between these groups. So that doesn't help, that somehow it seems to be preaching oneness, but somehow it really doesn't, that oneness is still in the background.
How does that work, Bernie? Maybe, you know, I could never figure it out. How, if you're one sect of a religion, and there's another sect of a religion, and, I know I'm probably going to hear from the Muslim community about this, how does one say, I am at war with you, the other ones, and I want to kill you people because there's something wrong? How do you do that?
Well, it's
that?
Amazing. No,
how is it done? I mean, where does it come from? How could you want to kill a fellow Muslim?
Well, it's hard to explain. You know, if the one God principle doesn't work even within the same religion, that you have the divisiveness. You have differences in almost all the religions between the Orthodox and the conservatives and the reforms, and they're at each other's throats. And you wonder, you say, well, but still, they all subscribe to this one God principle. Shouldn't that be the most powerful unifying element? And it isn't. It's very baffling. And I think the answer there is that many people who embrace these different points of views or religions or these concepts of oneness are doing it at a very mind level, that they really have not experienced the real foundation of our being, that sense of oneness.
Oh, but some of the most religious people I know who are, and I know, you know, again, a political statement here, the most religious people I know who pray and spend a significant amount of their life davening and praying to the wall and feeling their connection to God, and then they could step out of that and then move on to violence against, I don't know how that works. I'm confused by mankind. I'm confused by it. I'm confused by how you could kill someone else in the name of God. I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to me. Maybe I'm just not dense enough.
It doesn't make sense.
No, you have to explain this to me, Bernie. I've been asking this question for years. When I was a kid, I used to go to a Catholic school, and I remember the priest had a gun. The priest who I went to, where I went to school, Father Joe, he had a gun. And every now and then, when a kid would stand out of line, he'd pull out the gun. He had a little revolver. He'd pull it out, and he'd say, you know, you don't obey, I'm going to shoot you. It didn't drive us closer to the church. It didn't make us believe more. It didn't make us feel any closer, but we did obey. I thought that was the way it is.
Well, I've heard talks by authentic, deeply committed religious people who will acknowledge exactly what you're saying. And what they would say, you might dismiss this, is that those people, like the example you're giving of him pointing the gun, these people would say they don't really grasp the core meaning of the religion, that it's serving some other function in their lives. And, of course, historically, we could see that people embrace different religions for personal advantages, for power. I mean, religion is just as much prone to that as every other arena in life. So that may be one answer.
Yeah, it's just hard for me, and I know we're going to have to take a break, Bernie. And when we come back, we'll discuss this a little more, and we'll take calls around it. It's still hard for me to believe, because I do not believe that it is the people who are killing in the name of God are not religious people. They certainly are religious people. They certainly feel the connection to God.
Well, Armand, you're not alone in raising that question, and it's a very important one that we should be addressing.
We're going to take a short break, my friends, when we come back, a little music, and then we'll take your telephone calls as well. We'll be right back. We won't be right back. Any second now, we'll be right back. This is Armand DeMille.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations.
Stand by.
That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
You're back.
Mean to me. In answer to one of your questions that have come to us recently about the music that we play, at our website, thepositivemind.com, if you upload or you podcast or download or listen to or clue on to any of our programs, you will also get a listing of all the music that is played during that program. So if you're ever curious about the source of music or where the music comes from, like yesterday we played some music from Iceland. You know, if you're curious about where it is and the name of the thing, go to the website, go to the Positive Mind Archives, and you'll see the listing of the music. In fact, I've composed a list of all the music I ever played. What a list it is. In alphabetical order, which I think I'm going to have to offer as a premium during our fun drive. This is Armand DeMille here with you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial with Dr. Bernie Grad.
What am I graduating from?
No, Bernie Grad is a researcher up at McGill University. Bernie Starr. Bernie, you're talking about this. That's just for people who just tuned in because they heard Billie Holiday. We're talking about the Stanley Milgram research study in which it was indicated and suggested that people who can be under authority will be convinced to be harmful to other people. The New York Times did a release on it. The research was recently reproduced. And it talks about the nature of cruelty being that people, we now have a reason to understand why people are so cruel to other people, because authority may make them do it. Daddy made me do it. That was kind of the research that came out. Now, you were saying something about a Times...
Well, the New York Times editorial that we referred to before that reported on this and accepted the findings and... then said, well, the implications of this are clear. What we have to do is we have to train our soldiers to resist authority so that they don't just blindly, obediently follow orders that may inflict cruelty on others. Well, you might say easily said. I think that what probably is more important is to establish channels, the authentic channels where people know, like soldiers and military personnel, know that their complaints or their queries will be heard and will be taken seriously. And I say that because both, and remember, this was used as a model for cruelties in Holocaust, like in Nazi Germany and what Saddam Hussein did. But the fact is that in those societies, when, for example, doctors were recruited in Nazi Germany to do terrible things, they were told, well, you know, you don't have to accept this assignment. And they were also told that, and if you do accept it, and then it turns out you don't like it, you can quit. But most of them didn't believe that, and they thought that if they resisted, if they didn't go along, that they would be marked people, and their families would be marked, and their lives, and certainly their careers, would be over. And I think the same thing takes place in the military today. Certainly, we've seen examples of that with sexual harassment complaints, where many of the women who have been harassed said, well, they made complaints and nothing really happened, and others were punished for their complaints. So I think that what needs to be done is more with the administration, with the authorities, and establishing channels where people can be heard rather than changing the behaviors of people. Because, again, I don't think that most people will just blindly submit to cruel commands by authority.
Well, I don't know. Military is a really tough thing because, you know, if you think about how military works on testosterone. I mean, it's like a football field, you know? The way we get the soldiers to feel nothing and go over the hill suicidally, attempting what looks like courage, is we pump them with enough testosterone and we have them scream and we give them a gun and we say, go blow stuff up. And in mass, screaming together, they go over the hill and they do that. Now, that's the training. That's your training. You are told, pump up that testosterone, right? Now you pump that up and there you go and there are women. Well, what are you going to do, pumped up testosterone and there are women? Of course, you rape them, you kill, you do all that stuff. I think what you're saying is we got to somehow control, develop a new military without testosterone and, you know, give them negotiating tools. It's a very difficult thing.
Well, I don't know if you could develop a different military without testosterone. I mean, we know for a fact that life-threatening situations in general and certainly war situations puts people in an altered state of consciousness.
Sure.
And in that altered state of consciousness, all kinds of call it abnormal things or things that they would not do under other circumstances can take place.
The whole system stinks. The whole idea.
Well, war stinks.
War stinks.
We shouldn't be there. We shouldn't be at war.
War stinks. And this is Pacifica Radio. You know, I mean, war just stinks in general. And all kinds of war stink and killing stinks. And I know there are going to be people, if we open the phones, I would be sure that there would be people calling, justifying or defending. You know, but really the question I have is about the violence inside all of us. The question I have, and I've always had, is I see so many people who are so suppressed, repressed, depressed, unpressed. What else? How many other presses are there? And you get so many that what they need to do is to feel the animal inside them. They need to feel their growl. They need to feel the part of them that feels like power. So we sometimes do, remember therapy when we used to have people bounding walls?
When we were doing our primal work.
Well, we still do it here. You know, we have people who are depressed. We get them to where they could feel angry again. And feeling angry and being able to be angry is a very important thing for people because there's always a choice. It's either depression or anger. Either depressed people never get angry. And so if you want to get somebody out of depression, teach them about anger. But don't teach them to act it out. It's not acting it out and taking it out on people. So anger is not a bad thing. But violence.
No. I mean, anger is part of our makeup. And to not recognize that is to engage in denial.
So now, how do we deal with people and their own angry, repressed nature? So I'd like to take your calls at 212-209-2900. And I know the temptation is going to be to stand on the soapbox and talk about Israel, Gaza, and Iraq, Iran, George Bush, and Obama. You know what I mean? I know that's the temptation.
As opposed to the question that you brought up earlier, are we basically good or are we all basically prone to violence?
Are you basically a good person, a caring person, or are you prone to violence? And could you answer that for us, the people listening? 212-209-2900. I'd like to hear from some of you. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille. 212-209-2900. And again, as I said, if you're going to be a preacher, not right now. I want to hear people be more personal. Hi there, you're on the air.
Hello, Armand?
Yes.
How are you? Great show.
Is this Tony?
Yeah, Tony.
Hello, Tony.
There's no way you recognize my voice.
There is a way I recognize your voice.
God. Anyway, I love that music also, like I always tell you. You know what? I just have a question. You know, I'm not an educated person, so I don't have any background in this. It's just an inquiry and a question for you guys. I think that sometimes, as human beings, we think the world revolves around us, and we tend to complicate it, you know? I think that at our core, we are animals, and we have animal instincts. I'm not condoning any violence, but I'm just saying, you know, it's arrogant to assume that there are no, like, for example, other galaxies. It's arrogant to think that we're the only ones. And I think it's arrogant just because of our advanced intelligence compared to other animals that we are any better than they are. Is it right? It's not a matter of right or wrong. I just think that, you know, a lot of us are prone to violence. You put two pit bulls in a room, they're prone to violence. And sometimes certain men with other men or people with other people are prone to violence.
What about you, Tony? But what about you?
I'm not prone to violence.
But have you ever been?
I've never been prone to violence. I've always avoided conflict. I'm strictly the opposite. This is just the observation that there are people like that, just like there are animals that are more aggressive than others. You know, it's just an inquiry, a question. I've always been...
Sure.
You know, it's a thought. But I am incredibly competitive in sports. So I am very violent and aggressive in sports, but not against regular people where we're, you know, we're just hanging out and I'm going to beat somebody up. You know?
I remember I once met Russ Goings, who was a lineman for the New York Jets. One of the biggest, strongest men I ever met in my life. I don't think he's still with us nowadays. But I remember meeting him, and I remember when he shook my hand, which was about three times the size of mine, you know, and he was the most gentle man I ever met in my life. Right. He said, you know, there's something about not being afraid of anything that makes a difference.
Yeah. So what do you think about the question that I said?
Well, Tony, let me respond to that. I think you just gave the answer. When Armand asked you, are you prone to violence, you said no. And my response to that is, if you're not prone to violence, why can't that be true of most people?
Well, but not all.
Well, nothing's 100%. But right. The question is, are most people at their core? We indicate a lot of reasons why people have a lot of anger, hatred, violence within them. But at our core, are most of us prone to being good, to having a social conscience, to being compassionate toward other people, toward having a sense of connection, of oneness rather than separation? And if it's true of Tony, why can't it be true of most people?
Well, I agree with that. The only difference is that I think it's true only because it just happens to be. Not all animals are the same, and not all people are the same, but I don't think it's because we have a higher level of consciousness.
Okay, well, before we get into too much of a philosophical argument about it, discussion about it, because I'm trying to stay off the brain of it as much as the heart of it. You say something really important, Tony. You say, yes, me too. Me too. I don't want to see people hurt.
Absolutely.
I'm not afraid of confrontation. But I don't want to see people hurt, and I am I'm confused as well. I love it. 212. Let's take another call. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille asking you about yourself, not so much about your philosophical belief about the nature of the universe. Well, I guess we can talk about that, too. Hi there. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello there.
Yes, I'm calling because I wanted to comment about your interpretation of Islam.
Good, thank you.
I'm just curious because I think a lot of the reason why the West has such a big problem and is so scared is because they don't really understand that these people are living in a different time. They're living in the 1800s, if you will.
Are you part of the Islamic community?
Well, I mean, my family is.
Okay,
I renounced
so now,
Islam.
Now, I'm going to ask you what I'm going to ask you to do, if you don't mind, because I really value what you're going to say. Talk to me from the inside. Your family is a committed Islamic family in many ways, and you are not part of this? You didn't want to be part of it because you believe that they're living in the past?
Well, I believe that I was given a choice because I live in America. I was given a choice to think differently. I didn't only read one book my entire life.
Uh-huh.
And the problem here is, you know, these kids over there in Afghanistan and so on, a lot of them only read the Quran. They're not even allowed to read any other book.
And so you're saying that part of the study is because of the authorities dictating to you, therefore you're making the claim that is what we started with, is that because the authorities are convincing you of this, therefore it will engender your violence.
Right, exactly.
Well, you see, Bernie, there's a...
Well, but I think you're also saying something else, that when given a choice, okay, as you said, you're brought up in America, so you have a choice, you chose something else.
Right, I was given a choice.
So you didn't submit to the authority,
then. A lot of people don't have that. You know, a lot of people don't have that over there, you know, and that's the biggest problem. There are no choices.
Right, exactly. So that the problem for many people is not that they are necessarily just blindly bowing to authority, but that they don't have any choice, or the authority is very authoritarian.
Yes, I mean, if you look at Iran, look, you're not even allowed to hold hands in public, if you're married, even.
Well,
I
thank you very much. Just one more question. Who gave you the choice? Did your parents look at you and say, you can either be Islamic or not?
No, I gave myself the choice because I was...
Because you said I was given the choice.
Well, I was given the choice because I could think outside of the box because I wasn't living in Pakistan. That's where my parents are from.
Mm-hmm.
And since I was not Pakistani, being born there, I was American. That's what I chose. I chose that because I was here and I saw that there was another way to live.
Does it bother you? Does it make you angry that your family doesn't open their eyes to a more modern way of seeing things? Does it bother you that your parents are still stuck in the old way?
It doesn't because I understand it. I understand that if you're born a certain way and you live in a certain environment, you're probably going to cater to whatever that environment is.
Hmm.
And, you know, unless you have that choice early on in life, it's very difficult to change.
Well, you've changed. It's great for you. Thank you. What is your name?
My name is Naheed.
Naheed, thank you so much for calling in, and thank you for your contribution.
Okay, take care.
Right. 212-209-2900. We're learning. Hey there, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hi, Armand.
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Who is this?
Good. This is Eddie.
Hello, Eddie.
I'm arriving at work. I took my stepdaughter to a burial of her biological mom, and I went through a lot of feelings, and I was really grateful that I can be there and supportive to her. And I was listening to this subject, and I think that, you know, when you said something about this...
Wait a minute, Eddie. Hold on. Back up a little.
Okay.
You brought your daughter to...
My stepdaughter, yeah. She's my daughter, yeah.
You brought your stepdaughter to her mother's funeral?
Yes.
My God. How did that attach you? How did that touch you? How sad that must have been for you.
Well, very sad.
I mean, I don't want to just pass over this, but...
Yeah.
I mean, it must have ripped your heart out.
It certainly did.
How did you deal with that while you have the care of a young girl? How old is your daughter?
She's 19.
So you have the care of her. Did she see how sad you felt at the same time? Did she see it, or were you holding yourself together for her?
No, I was very easily... and comfortable with sharing my tears and letting and embracing her and being totally present for what was going on, and I'm very grateful for that.
What was mom's name?
Iris.
Iris? So Iris has kind of got buried today, right?
Yes.
Well, let's send
her. Came from the cemetery now.
Yeah, let's send her a message. Let's send her a little. What would you say to her if you could say something to the spirit of Iris? As she passes over the universe, whatever she's doing, what would you say to her directly?
I would say to her that her spirit lives.
Mm-hmm.
I would say to her that in her daughter lives her spirit. I would tell her that I am totally proud of the life that she led, and the gift of being able to be observant and see the family members and the people, so many people showing up for her, just was evident to me that the kind of person she was. So I would say thank you, Iris.
Say it. Thank you, Iris.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that beauty with us.
You're quite welcome. Have a wonderful day, Mark.
Thank you, Eddie.
Okay, bye.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Sometimes I just have to stop in the middle of things. I knew Eddie wanted to make contact with me.
That was very moving.
212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, let's take another call. Hello there.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good, I'm here. We got about 2 minutes.
Okay, quickly, what happens with me is that oftentimes I find myself really, like, criticizing a lot of people and thinking bad things about a lot of people until I get to talk to them. And once I talk to them, I say, what is wrong with me? Why were you thinking all these negative things about them? They're really nice. And I think that I know we're not supposed to extrapolate to wider scales, but on a wider level, I think that's pretty much what happens. As long as they're the other, it's so easy to hate, you know.
Well, that's the thing that you're saying, you know, as long as we could make it the other, you know, it's easy to hurt, to hate.
And to throw my insecurities, my jealousies, you know, onto people I don't know. Oh, you know, they have so much, and, you know, they never had to do this and that, and they've always had it easy, and, you know, they don't care about anybody but themselves. Well, how do I know this? I don't even know them.
What's your name?
Know.
Your name?
My name's Steph.
Steph?
Yeah,
Yeah. Yeah. So you've learned a great deal about your own aggression and your own anger.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you've learned to love people a little better.
Absolutely. And like the other gentleman that called, I'm a very competitive person. I play tennis, and I'm in sales, and that's how I get it out of my system.
I gotcha.
But I do love people, you know, and...
I think that's the point of what Bernie's been pointing us to today, is that we, you know, we're basically a loving group.
We really are. And violence is not natural. I totally... believe that, you know, we're pleasure-seeking folk, and violence is not pleasurable.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Steph, for being with us.
Thank you.
Another kudos to Iris, wherever you are. Good luck to Yo-Yo as well, who is currently awaiting his goodness. We will be back with you tomorrow, my friends. At 1 p.m. Bernie, I want to thank you so much for being with us. That's really important.
Well, thank
stuff.
You, Armand. It was really terrific today.
Yeah. See us again. Bye-bye, my friends.
The universe thoughts meander like a restless wind inside a letterbox. They tumble blindly as they make their way across the universe.
You're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and W.